All right, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. Nice to see you. I'm not really seeing you, but you know what I mean. Sort of in a general sense, see you. I'm going to get to my guest in a second. Old friend, very funny comedian. But before I do that, there's something that's really bothering me. A couple of things. First of all, I was watching Good Morning America this morning. I had it on. I was getting ready to go out. But wait, actually now I'm got live with Ryan and Kelly, or Kelly and Ryan, and there's a guy dancing as they announce prizes, and it's this pear-shaped guy. Just stop dancing. There's too much dancing going on. Everybody's dancing. It's just, nobody should be that happy. And the guy just looked like he was thrown out a hip every time he moved. But the Good Morning America thing is they had this segment where they had this giant counter of stuff, and they have like a woman from QVC, and they were giving people deals of the day, and it's like supposed to be a news show, and there were 29 different items, and the woman's like, you know, these are umbrellas, and the water bounces off them, and it's normally $50, $25, and a meat grinder that's normally $150, $75. I don't even know if anybody buys meat grinders anymore, but you get the point. But the problem was that every time she said an item and then said the amount, the audience clapped. Ooh, ooh. And like, stop it. You shouldn't be clapping at that. You really should be just giving the finger. That's what you should do. If you're in that studio and it's live and they tell you to clap, just say you're going to clap. And then the woman does the thing. It says the amount of the price of the thing. You flip the bird, because this is not good. This stuff, we just at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you can get this for this and this for that. I gotta go hit somebody. That's kind of where I am right now. My guest, a good friend of mine, Lisa Lampanelli, very funny comedian. Know her from the Comedy Central roasts and a whole bunch of other stuff. Celebrity Apprentice, her own comedy specials, Queen of Mean. But she's doing different stuff these days, and she's got a really cool play out, and you guys should see it. It's about her issues with weight and everything else, and just really fun interview with her that kind of really gets you to see another side of her, which maybe you don't often get to see in here. So enjoy, Lisa. Please leave some comments on iTunes, and please send the links around. We want to keep building a following. Appreciate you guys checking it out, and we'll catch you next week. Here we are, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. I am sitting here with an old dear friend, very, very, very funny comedian and a sweetheart of a person. Aww. With beautiful blue hair.
I know. What's going on there?
You look like an Upper East Side poodle.
Like, well, I do live on the Upper East Side.
Do you?
And I really fit
I
in
live
with...
there, too. I live on 87th Street. Where do you live?
Oh, my God. 72nd.
We got to get together and fuck.
Oh, my God, dude.
Come on, this
oh
is crazy.
I always thought you were married. Are you married?
I am, but she's not here.
Well, you know, I don't have sex anymore.
Oh, you don't?
And I'm not even making a joke. You know, we talk real on this show.
Yeah,
I've heard your podcast.
Yeah.
No, I've been celibate for 4.5 years.
Really?
Yeah. And divorced for 2.5, which is probably why... Then once I did the math, this is seriously true. But honestly, I decided not to date for a while because I'm like, I'm just going to work on me till I figure out what I really should be dating.
Yeah. And because, you've been divorced twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that only a few people know that, but you know,
yeah, of
it
course.
Because I, you know, yeah.
Well, let's say, you know,
back in the day we talked.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know?
So this, by the way, I should probably say who this is. This
oh,
is
yeah, like, right?
This is like
Kathy Griffin with blue hair.
Basically. Oh, you haven't had as much work done on the face. This is Lisa Lampanelli. So funny. You know her from the Comedy Central roasts,
yes.
5 comedy specials, The Tonight Show, and you're going to know her big time from a play that she has coming out, and I love this title. The minute I read, I laughed out loud. My wife laughed out loud. I'm
aww.
Like, this is totally, totally a Lisa Lampanelli title. Her play is called Stuffed, a Big Bone Skinny Ass, All You Can Eat, All You Can Laugh play, and it's... You ran this last year in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
You're in previews starting October 5th at the West Side Theater.
Yes.
It's off Broadway, and you can get tickets now. And then it opens full time, premiere, big time shit, October 19th.
Right.
And it's going to run for at least 5 months, but probably longer.
I hope so. Yeah, because it's one of those shows that I think, you know, it's a cast of 4 women.
Yeah, I don't give a shit. I want to talk about you not fucking guys for 4.5 years. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. So it has to do with you were You were heavy at one time?
Yeah, I've been every size from a size 0 to a size 26. And I was like, my struggle with food and eating has got to translate to some work. Mm. So I said, let me write this play so that I can help other people, but also make some freaking money off my fatness. So now that I'm skinny and gorgeous.
We know we all made money off your fatness. All the comics on the side were betting how fat or skinny you would be week to week. And I always had the over and under of 250.
Over and under, you would have won. But no, I'm telling you, it was such a pain in the ass. So then because I've worked on my weight since I was 18 years old to 50 years old and now and above. So I said, you know what? Let me get this weight loss surgery. I just had my anniversary. I kept all my weight off for 5 years. I didn't pull one of those things where you gain it back like Ralphie May or Paula Carney Wilson, as we call it in the business, or as I call her, Chili Con Carney. I love you, Carney. I'm just kidding, but I'm not.
She was on my podcast and she played recordings of her farts. She records her farts and names them.
Okay, see, that's pretty damaged. She's what we call a dented can.
And by the way, we should let people know that we've been friends together from comedy for a long, long time. And what I love about you is, you know, a lot of people don't, like, when you really make it, the people think, oh, well, it just kind of happened, you know?
Yes.
And you know, we would work the clubs in the city a lot. You'd work the road like we all did. But then you would do this thing at Caroline's. You would have a show, I think it was weekly. And then you had, I can't remember the guy's name, but you had a guy that, like, kind of worked with you and helped you. And after every show, you would talk to the fans, to the guests, to the customers. You would get email addresses, you would follow up and real grassroots. And then, you know, your act was getting stronger and stronger, and then you blew up, and it all kind of came together. And I always thought that was so great to see, like, not just the talent, but the work all kind of come together.
Oh, thanks. Because I did have that work ethic, and I still do. And I think that's why we accomplish anything. Comics aren't people. People think, I'm going to be a comic so I could sleep all day.
Right, exactly.
And as you know, it's one of the harder jobs in entertainment. And you go, well, you have to be motivated. You have to be scrappy. So back then, people had just started using computers. And I remember poor Gay Wendell. That was the guy.
Oh, Gay Wendell, right.
Gay Wendell would do a drawing before every show. So people would throw their email address in the bowl and he would pick one out. I don't know what the hell they were supposed to win, but I got their freaking email addresses. Probably half those idiots are still on my email list. But isn't it weird how you're just killing time till you make it, but you're working. You and I have probably written 18 pilots between us, but it's whatever takes off. You're still grinding away every day.
Yeah, and you don't know. And then, you know, in your case too, you know, Queen Amin and how killer funny. My wife's reading. She likes to just, who are you having on? Oh, and she starts to read stuff, and then she starts reciting some of your jokes
to
me. And
I'm like, awesome.
And one was like, a black woman with an abortion.
God, I got so much shit for that joke. And by the way, that's just a parlor joke.
Yeah.
Like, I would always put in the middle of my hour set a couple of parlor jokes for when the people were paying the checks or whatever. So it was, what do you call a black woman with 11 abortions? A crime fighter. So it's just funny. But the thing is,
Roy, the engineer,
he's even laughing.
Not to laugh.
And he's a white skinhead, which proves a lot why he's laughing, Charlottesville.
Was such a great altar to Hitler that you made.
I just feel like those jokes, I do obviously still a lot of insult comedy, a lot of, I think, but the roast jokes to me are so funny.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's a throwback. And it's,
don't you like, I like the old school.
And, you know, Rickles being gone now.
Yes, yes. Joan.
And Joan. And we, you know, when I was working at the Daily Show, we had Rickles on the show. And then we said, can we come and see him? He was in Atlantic City. So his manager, the Italian guy, I can't remember.
Tony. Yep.
Tony, really nice guy. He sets us up with tickets. So 15 of us go. We get one of those big buses, right? And we go, can you please sit us down front?
Yes.
Because, you know, you want to hopefully be picked on by the king, the god. So they sit us down front. And, you know, it's essentially, you know, an Atlantic City Vegas showroom. And so it's got those long sort of tables. And we're sitting there. And one of the guys, a guy named Jim Merrill, really funny guy out of San Francisco, comedian. But he's white and skinny as all get out, right? And so Rickles comes on, the tuxedo, the tumbler of scotch, the band's playing, and then he starts just stalking the stage. You could see like a cat, like looking, and he goes back and forth, and then he makes eye contact with Jim Merle, and Jim Merle is like about 100 pounds, soaking wet, and super skinny and super white, and he goes, "I'm a friend. Get a mask." and they were like, "We just got inside." It was the best.
Can I tell you, I learned so much from Rickles from a joke just like that. Because it's so simple.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful that you know he can't mean it.
Yeah.
You see? That's why when I the first joke that Rickles did that killed me and I kept in mind to always be this silly or else people are going to take me seriously. Right. He would say, "Thank God for Mexicans or there wouldn't be filth." Now, you can't say that if you mean it.
Right.
So I go, always dumb your jokes down. Really make them silly and people will know you love them.
Yeah.
You know? When I saw Rickles, the Friars Club made me meet him because they're like, "Oh, you know, that'll be inspiring for you." So he says to me backstage in that same Atlantic City thing, he had the robe on with the initials and this and that. And he goes, "I heard you do this thing that I do. So one word of advice, work clean. So you could work anywhere." And of course, to him, I'm like, "Oh, okay, thank you, Mr. Rickles." And inside, I'm going, "Fuck you, you old Jew. I'm freaking going to work a bar mitzvah. Get the fuck out of here. Die already." But it was so funny because I go, he meant well.
Yeah.
But isn't that nice that he would even meet me?
Oh, yeah. And sort of like want to help somebody that's, you know, some comics can be very sort of competitive and insular and not want to, that he kind of reached out to you like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you said a thing because you've also sort of transitioned. And we're going to talk more about the play, but you talked about sort of how in your act, you're just talking about your real life now too. And, but in talking about sort of the insult stuff, and I like to talk to the audience too. And I do think it's important because, you know, especially now, especially if you're a white male, like you can't, anytime you touch on something that's remotely potential, not PC, like race.
Yes.
Like I'll say to somebody, "So you're black," and the crowd will go, "Huh?" And I'm like, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
Yeah.
The guy's black. Are we at the point where I can't even call
Describe.
A spade, no pun intended. But I don't do it for that. I've never really done that as a joke, but the black thing, or like somebody will be Indian. And I'll say to Indian people, I'll say, they'll be married. I'll say, "Is that an arranged marriage?"
Sure.
And they'll go, "Huh?" I go, "Are you so culturally sort of on the off the reservation that you don't know that that's still a thing in India? They still arrange marriages."
What's really funny is you just said off the reservation and you're thinking of the other type of
right, exactly.
So
I didn't mean that.
You really lumped them in good. See, that's why you got to write for me.
I'm slamming people and I don't even know it. But the thing is, like you said about sort of making fun of people or the insult stuff. The thing is, this is your quote, "People sense when you have the least bit of anger or hate towards a group. That's why you never make fun of people you don't like."
Yeah, I've honestly, other than roasts, because with roasts, you have to sort of spread it around equally. So I can make fun of a Trump or whoever I'm not that crazy about.
Right.
But really, in the audience, I can't think. I always say, you know, I make fun of every race, color, creed, sexual abomination.
Yeah.
That's why I don't make fun of the French, because I fucking hate them. I mean, and what was wild, Paul, oh my God, you're going to laugh, because you know how everybody hates the French.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody just does. Mm. I said that joke one night and nobody laughed, because they always usually laugh when I make fun of the French and say that about the French. I go home and put on the TV. That was the day they did that shooting in Paris.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, I torture myself for 24 hours. So who's the real victim of that tragedy? Lisa Lampanelli. But isn't it wild? You really have to have an open heart and love everybody. Because Rickles didn't hate anybody.
No.
That's the whole thing. If you have prejudice, they sense it.
Yeah. But also you should be able to talk about sort of, you know, those things that, like we're Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And when they hear that I'm Italian or you're Italian, people instantly go to mafia.
Sure.
And you know, I could get upset about that.
Yeah.
But it's just sort of, you know, and we can't say anything about it because we're not the minority anymore. When my grandparents came here in 1910, they were the minorities who did all the shit jobs. But now we've assimilated into the majority. So it's okay to make off-color jokes about Italians, but you can't make off-color jokes about anybody, you know. And so it's sort of like, and I talk about it in my act, like I don't even know where the line of racism is at this point. Like
I think the only people you can make fun of now openly are fat people. And I honestly mean
I don't even think you can do that.
Well,
unless
not,
you're fat, because it's such a fat-shaming sensitive time.
Now that whole fat-shaming did start, but I just read today about a woman who pulled her kid out of school because she said the teacher was too fat, so she probably couldn't defend the kids in times of trouble. And I'm like, I know as many fat bitches as skinny ones who could do a marathon or do Pilates, yeah. So step off. But it is pretty funny. When I lost the weight, I lost 107 pounds.
Yeah.
I swear to God, losing the weight was easy. Keeping it off is hard. But the hardest thing ever is living as a fat person because you're treated like shit.
You were.
You're allowed to say, look at this fat cunt. You know, yeah. I don't mind the cunt part, but the fat part is terrible.
I would always call you a cunt.
I love the cunt part. To me, it was foreplay, you know? But it's interesting to me. And now that I lost the weight, I'm a little more conscious of going, I still have to do fat jokes. Because that would be really two-faced if I didn't. If I make fun of everybody but fat women, that's not fair.
Yeah, but so you have to put it in context with you because they know that you were fat at one time.
Yes, and also they know I'm an insult comic, so they know what they're signing up for.
So are you? So we're both Italian, and sort of reading about this place more. You know, you said this is an issue for you since you were 18 years old.
Yeah.
And I look at the way we would eat growing up. And it's bread and it's pasta and it's salami and, you know, and that's like a snack on the way to dinner,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's more and it's more. And then like I met my wife who's a WASP, okay, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Right.
So they, you know, they don't emote,
they eat.
Drink martinis and get divorced. Yeah. And they don't, or what they eat is like steak and potatoes and whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time my wife, a couple of things happened. She came to a big family dinner on a Sunday and she goes, I go, how did you like it? She goes, why was everybody mad at each other?
Oh,
I go, what
God.
Do you mean? She goes, well, there was a lot of yelling. I
oh,
go,
yeah.
No, we weren't yelling. We were just talking. That's how we talk.
That's how we talk.
And he goes, and why was there all that food? Did people not know that other people were going to make food? I go, no. She goes, but there were like three appetizers and four entrees. I go, yeah. So my long-winded setup for this question is part of your, I think, our culture and lifestyle maybe contributed to your weight issues?
Oh, my God, yeah, because my mother's house was the original Olive Garden. You know, in fact, Olive Garden was the nickname for her privates. When you're there, you're family. But she honestly...
Your mother is a good lay, though, I'll tell you.
Oh, she's good in the sack, man. Even at 87. God bless her. But I'll tell you what, the only time I remember my mother really being happy and smiling was when we ate. So it was, for me, a very emotional thing. But I never gained weight till college because I never ate out of sadness till I got to college. So when I went to college, just, you know how...
BC and Syracuse, right?
Yeah, it just sent me crazy because I was alone. I was lonely. I didn't have family. I was so... That's where the family base came in to almost bite me in the
but
ass.
But you grew
we
up in Trumbull, Connecticut. You weren't far from home, really. I mean,
I know, but I felt stranded.
Really?
Like, I felt like... and also, Paul, I make a joke about this, but it's true. I had a date rapist who took no for an answer. Now, there's nothing more insulting as a fat chick than having a guy look at you and
wait,
go, those rapists.
You're not doing a bit, right?
No.
Okay, so tell me how this happens.
I worked in a food place as my work study program. I met this basketball player who was super hot, and he was a senior, and I was a freshman.
Black guy?
No, white guy.
Oh, really?
Really sexy and cute. And I knew he had sort of a reputation as a date rapist. Like, I know that's bad, but I was like, kind of like, oh, I'm lonely. And I had never had sex. I'm a very late bloomer, Paul. I never had sex till I was 22.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up a long time ago. So I go out for a date with this guy and I'm not going to put out, but I figure, well, at least we'll make out because I loved making out. I still do.
Yeah.
This guy tries to get a little forceful and I go, no. And he goes, and this was pretty scary. He goes, you're lucky you caught me on a day that I'll take no for an answer.
Did he say
left.
That?
Dude, yeah. And it's really scary. And I was like crying and stuff. But then I'm like kind of insulted too because I'm like, I guess I'm not that cute. So I think that set me into a whole different thing. So food was literally my only friend.
Right.
And
but it wasn't an issue for you when you were growing up because you had a happy environment.
Right. And I think it was making my mom happy and I was active, like I was doing sports and running around.
Yeah.
The second I went to college, it like all just became too much. Food was the only thing instead of one of the good things.
And then it gets harder to date because, you know, fat chicks aren't, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
and
well,
it's
we
like,
try harder.
Yeah.
but I don't. You know, I'm like, no. That's what's funny about it. Ever since I lost the weight and I'm celibate, I'm like, I don't try at all. I will not suck a dick.
Really?
I never did before.
I saw you jerking off the custodian in the building.
Yeah,
on the way
but
in.
You know, this happens once in a blue moon.
That hand, you have no control over that
Sometimes
hand.
Sometimes it's Tourette's. But it's odd. It's like, I don't even want to, like, I think when you go through menopause, you kind of shut down and you don't have to have sex. Then you realize how much your life has been muddied up by this man thing.
Right.
And you go, wait, I'm just going to wait and see what flushes out. If I'm supposed to date, I will.
So why didn't your two marriages work out? And don't say it's all them, because
no,
it never was.
No, I've
any relationship
publicly,
that breaks down, it's both
people.
It was
all me, guaranteed.
Well, it can't be all you either.
It's guaranteed most of it was.
And I know your second husband. He's a nice guy.
Nice guy.
Great
We're
guy.
Still friends. Mm-hmm. I went to his wedding that he had it last year. It was that I picked the wrong person for me.
So the first one was wrong for you. How?
He was a bit of a rebound. He was definitely a rebound. I had dated a guy who was a real bad boy, like horrible. Like he had just gotten out of prison. Shockingly, also a white guy.
Jesus.
And he, I know. I had one
You're
black
so racist. Why don't you?
I know. Why wasn't I dating the rapist from the blacks?
You're dating the white people who have jobs that the blacks should have.
Yeah, exactly. I know they should. So this guy was in jail. He got out. He was crazy. And so then I went to the extreme and date a very safe guy. Now, when you date on a rebound and you date the opposite, that's not what you want either. You want something in between. You don't want too safe. You didn't want too edgy. You want that nice guy in between.
Are you like a handful emotionally when you're
anymore,
not working? Like, were you like very needy? Like needed a lot? It's me. My set sucked.
Yeah.
Why aren't I getting this and all of those?
No, I was more like, I'm funnier than you, because he was a beginning comic. So we were both beginning comics, and I was like, you know, you're
this the first one?
Yeah. I was just like, he quit the business because I was like, yeah, I'm funnier. Just drive me around. Like, you know, we have to have
just
big
drive
egos.
Me around.
You know, if you don't think, by the way, that you're the funniest comic in the world who's ever lived, you're never going to make it, because you are so put upon by this business, and it's such a hard business that you got to have that confidence. So I'd be with
So back up,
boyfriends.
When you say put upon, I'm fascinated by that. I agree with you, but I want people to who are either comics or not and listening to this understand.
Yeah.
When you say put upon, meaning there are so many forms of rejection that come at you on a daily basis. If you start to believe in any of those, your confidence goes away.
Yes.
Your motivation to write and create goes away, and you just sort of flounder in this middle.
Right. And it really takes the whole wind out of your sails. So if you don't believe how great you are, even as a beginner, my first time on stage, I was like, I'm a comic. So you have
Did you ever have those moments of losing confidence and like, is this going to happen? And I'm banging my head against the wall and what the fuck and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And the next day you either wake up and you have the choice to quit or to not. I was lucky enough where I always go, hey, Lisa, what's the worst that can happen? You don't want to do it anymore? You can type. I'm a good typist. I type 120 words a minute. I say, you know what? What's the worst that can happen?
But would you have been able to, and I mean this in the third person, but also for you, let's say you did that. You just say, you know, I gave it a try. It's 5 years. I can't deal with it. I'm going to go, well, you were a journalism major and you did journalism, so you go back to writing it. Would you have then had those nights where you're flipping around and you see a comic on TV and you go, Would it stay with you that you didn't make it? Would it hurt that you
probably left, walked away? But I think then that's when you said, I made the choice. I can either go get therapy, or I could drive everybody around me crazy, or I can try it again. Sometimes the timing's not right. I got lucky that I didn't start till I was 30. So you already kind of knew I had some guts. And
you were a journalist. Tell people what you were a journalism major.
Yeah, I went to Syracuse for journalism. Right. And I worked for Rolling Stone. I worked for Spy. I worked for all these heavy metal magazines in the 80s.
Right.
And I was the only female heavy metal journalist who never even got fingered by Blackie Lawless from Wasp. I'm like, really?
You're
That's
a loser
you
on
you're
so
fat.
Many levels.
I know. I'm a loser.
Were you
dream.
Fat then?
Oh, yeah. All through my 20s. Maybe that's why Baby Jesus made me fat, so that I didn't have sex with Blackie Lawless from Wasp. And I really ended up going, you know what? This isn't working for me. I should try comedy. But honestly, at the end of the day, every time I'd have a bad show or every time I'd be crying or upset, I'd remember, well, if this doesn't feel better in the next few days, I got to make a choice. I could quit. Yeah. I could stick with it. I could get help.
Yeah.
And I always sought help. Like I'd call a writer and I'd be like, can you help me with a class? Can you like figure out how I can make this joke work? And then it would work. So Rich Voss, as bitter and crazy as he is and how much we love him, he was so nice to me once when he saw I was down one day and he goes, always look back on the previous year and say, am I better off than I was last year as a person and as a comic and an entertainer? And if the answer is yes, you move forward.
Rich Voss said that?
Yeah. He was really moral. I mean, he is a moral great guy.
No, I know.
Yeah, I know.
I just didn't think he was smart enough to put that many words together.
He really is. And he lisped a lot, though. I know. It was cute. Listen to me.
Yeah. You got to wear a sneeze guard when you talk to him.
It's so adorable.
And I love him. He's actually a really great guy. With a tough exterior, but a, you know,
he's like me again. He's like a Tootsie Pop, soft on the inside, hard on the outside. But honestly, all we want people to do is listen.
It's a great perspective, though. If you're better off than you were a year ago, then you're moving in the right direction.
And honestly, Paul,
how do you gauge better off? Like,
I was just going to say to you, I am, this is probably the first time I'm saying this out loud on the air. My ticket sales will probably never be as good as they were 7 years ago. 7 years ago, it was when I was nominated for the first Grammy. When I had the HBO special.
Won a Grammy in 2010.
Or was up for one, and I was up for one last year when I sold out Carnegie Hall in Radio City. That was the height of it. Ever since then, I got to work a little harder to sell those tickets.
Why do you think that is? Harder. And everybody does.
Yeah, and I think
everybody does.
I think because a person told me over the weekend, you never stay at the top or the bottom, you always are somewhere in the middle. I think it was because I stopped doing the roasts and I wasn't as visible. I started writing a play, and that took really my heart. My whole heart is into that. I took care of my dad when he was in hospice. My life is better now, despite having to work harder to sell tickets. I could judge my life as being so much better.
Why?
Just because I don't want to say spiritually, but I'm doing more service for people. The play is a total service to help women and gay men and maybe the occasional open-minded straight guy to feel better about themselves physically, to seek help, to get therapy, to feel less
that.
Alone.
No,
I know.
No.
A lot of it is to add a laughter of a subject that a lot of people deal with, which is food and
so
body shaming.
So you're saying that there was happiness from selling out Carnegie Hall and the money rolling
to
in?
To be honest, there wasn't happiness out of it.
Everybody says that.
No, can
that.
I tell you? Can
Why
I,
is
no, there
that?
Was, it was, can I tell you what I remember about Carnegie Hall?
And the reason
I'll tell you why.
Go ahead.
If you ask me what I remember about that night is my sister and her husband took my parents into the city and my dad and my mom, I have the picture. We ate dinner at a steakhouse before and I paid the whole check. And some of my nephews and nieces were there. Like my best memories from the past year are game night with my mom. Like I'm super simple. Like I'm 56. After my dad died, I learned honestly nothing in comedy or entertainment feels as good as game night. It's freaking crazy. It's a miracle, dude. Cause I was so tied up with this career stuff. Now I'm like, oh, if it happens, it's supposed to.
I mean, I'm super busy and it's all good, but then, you know, I make myself take some time, especially in the summer, my kids out of school. And then I get to a point sometimes where, you know, that feeling like on Sunday, you got to go back to school on Monday. You don't want to go back.
Yes.
It's like, man, I wish I could figure out a way where I don't have to go back to, and then I look what I'm going back to, you know, the Late Show and this and that.
Yes,
oh, that's great.
Yes.
Do you find yourself on game night saying,
I wish I could stay in Connecticut forever? Yeah. When I did my last comedy show last week, because I have to take 6 months for the play and rehearsals, I go, I wonder if I'm going to miss comedy. Fuck no, dude. And it's not because I don't like it. It's because I'm involved with this other project. But then when this ends, imagine, suppose I do something else. Like, it's just
Or it might refresh you. It might reinvigorate
to
you to do comedy. Sometimes you
exactly.
just need to step away. So you find now, and I do think you're right, and it's, it has nothing to do with your talent. I think there's so much in terms of sort of you hit this mark and this high water mark, and then you maybe slide down, and maybe you come back, and maybe you don't, but that's okay, because even if you slide down from that high water mark, it's still pretty goddamn high. But I do think a big thing is that you're competing with so much entertainment and information coming at people. It wasn't like when we were growing up, there were three or four major networks and some basic cable stations.
Right.
You've got this person with a podcast, this person with a web video series, this person with a TV show, this, then boom, 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 boom. It's like, how do you cut through the clutter and continue? And obviously you chose to have powder blue hair. But,
yes.
I think that probably contributes to, I think it probably expedites people falling off that high perch a little faster than you normally would.
Well, you know what's interesting about it, too, is that if you just stick to what you do, I called Brian Regan,
good friend of mine,
virtually
great guy,
does no TV whatsoever. And I said to him, Brian, I notice all the time when I'm leaving a theater, you're either coming there the next week or the week you were just there. How do you sell tickets? Because it used to be a mystery to me. I said, how do you? He goes, it's still hard in some markets like everybody else, but I just write new material all the time so they know that when they see me again there, I'm going to have a new hour. And so he just does his job.
I opened for him. I was on the road with him a lot.
Yeah.
He came up in a time when he started in Florida, mm-hmm. and you could go into a market 3 or 4 times a year.
Yeah.
Word of mouth and some advertising. And then radio and comedy was a hot mix. So you could go on a shit ton of radio. Yeah. It's harder now because the large corporations own the radio stations and they only want comics on if the club will pay for advertising. The clubs don't want to pay for advertising. Mm-hmm. And he built in those markets. Then he had a couple of CDs and one caught fire. And he does his show. Mm-hmm. And then he comes out for an encore.
For the great hits, right?
And they just start yelling, the big one's the sun. And they literally start yelling the punchlines.
How great is that?
And then he goes, okay, well, comedy's supposed to be a surprise, but apparently that doesn't matter. And then he goes in.
Not for him, it doesn't.
And he just goes into 15 or 20 minutes. I opened for him one time, and his hip locked up. Just before the show, like literally like minutes before the show. So he goes, I don't know what we're going to do. So we come up with this plan. So I go out and I do my thing. And then I bring him out and he sits on a stool and he explains that I have to sit, which I never do because my hip is fucked up. And after this, I got to go get it checked. Mm-hmm. He goes, but we thought we'd have some fun. So I'm a physical comic. So some of these bits, Paul will act out as I say them. And I got to act out. Dude. You know that bit he does about, did you ever see a guy from afar walking and he walks into a spider web and you don't see the spider web, but you just see him going crazy. And then the guy's like playing his song. So I'm doing this bit. Turned out, the reason he had the hip problem is if you watch him and you watch his technique and rhythms, he'll start standing up. When he gets to his punchline, he crouches down.
Uh-huh.
It's just this physical thing that he does, like literally almost on every joke. He'll start straight and then he'll get to, and then the bird said, fuck you. And then he's crouched over and he did it so much that he fucked up his hip. And the doctor literally goes, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm doing this. And the doctor literally said, not as a joke, well, don't do that anymore.
Oh, sorry, right. Dude.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, can do.
But yeah, I mean, even Lewis Black. I mean, Lewis Black popped a lot when he was on The Daily Show, but he's another guy I just think through writing, yes. Strong point of view.
And I think the whole point is to just do whatever you love and it will happen. I was telling your engineer before you came in, it was so funny. My nephew's fiance started a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
She's just, you know, a beginning comedy writer. They just hit 1 million downloads just because she thought it would be fun. And it's very good. And That's Why We Drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her and her friend talking about paranormal experiences and crime, but that's why they drink. And it's so funny that in their gut, they knew this was fun. So I think That's Why Stuffed and the podcast I'm doing, they're going to take off as much as they are going to if I'm having fun.
Yes. Well, let's talk
but
about
anything that I'm not having fun with, by the way. If my face doesn't light up when I'm talking about it, I don't do it.
Yeah, but you can afford to not have fun with something and walk away now.
Yeah,
no, I mean, career-wise and financially. So what did you do when you were in that place where, you know, you're making a good living or whatever, but you have to do some things you don't want to do? How would you make yourself do those things? What kind of things were they, or what would you?
I actually remember when I was just starting as a comic, like maybe 5 years in, I moved back with my parents for a year. I remember when I was beginning, and I wanted everyone in New York to think I lived in New York. So I wanted Lucian and all those guys at the comic strip and all the different clubs to call me for spots at the last minute.
Oh, yeah.
So I lied and said I got a New York phone number, and I literally, you're going to die, lived on as a maid with a college degree and graduate school credits as a maid in a 60-acre estate right outside of New York, cleaning this woman's house because I was like, I want to make it as a comic. So I would always find a way. I did everything. I always say to these beginning comics, and they all hate me for it, and I don't give a fuck. I always go, if you haven't slept in your car on the way to Florida driving 21 hours by yourself because you can't afford the hotel room in South Carolina, you're not a real comic.
Yeah.
So anytime somebody wah-wahs,
yeah.
You know who I feel sorry for? Anne Frank was in the attic. Right. I don't fucking feel sorry for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So I would do any odd job it took. But now I'm not Jim Carrey rich or whatever, or Eddie Murphy rich. But thank God, if I had a quit tomorrow, say my mom got really sick and I had to quit, sell a house, do something. You don't have to, you can move in with your mom. Like, you don't have to struggle if you don't want to. So I think I've been very fortunate. That's why you'll never hear me complain. You really don't hear me complain.
This goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. It's I think it's good fortune, but I think it's talent. And I think it's very hard work. Charlie Rose said he's interviewed the biggest of the biggest, entertainment, business, politics. And he said, I used to think that these people that are at the pinnacle of what they do, are it's because of their innate talent, that God touched them to be Michael Jordan or to be, Bono or whatever. Yes. And he said, but over my years of interviewing people, the difference between those people and other people is the work.
Totally.
There's definitely talent there, but there's that thing that you, whether it's commitment or, you know, like in my case, I walked away from Wall Street to be a comic. So I sold my apartment on the Upper West Side and I completely redid my life. And I moved to a rooming house in New Rochelle where there was a phone sex operator who lived above me, 300 pounds. Yeah. And I've actually written a one-man show about this, which we're trying to get, I'm looking for a director now to work with me. So I'm really taking an interest in what you're doing because you're doing something about your life, what I want to do with my life. I talk about it on stage as a comic, but I want to. So I totally agree with you about that. You really have to decide like that this is almost some obsessive calling because you're going to get hit so much. So the podcast is called
Started. It's called Get Stuffed with Lisa Napinelli.
And Frank DeCaro, who's a friend of mine from The Daily Show, is going to be calling in to
talk. Well, here's the deal. Get Stuffed is really me because I've worked on my life so much.
And people can hear it on iTunes.
iTunes. Okay. It's feralaudio.com. I tell you what, I have the impression that I can fix everybody because I really have fixed my life. I'm so happy. I'm like very fortunate. So Frank DeCaro is my opening act on the road. So he at one point got a doctor's report that if he didn't lose 100 pounds, he would die. I get wind of this. I fucking have an intervention. He lost 105 pounds. I said, you fat fuck, listen, I won't have it.
Did he,
get his stomach cut out?
Yeah.
No, he did it through old-fashioned way, diet and exercise. And so he calls in once a week to do a weigh-in because if he doesn't keep the weight off, he's getting punished.
Oh, wow.
So me and my co-host Mike Morse kind of help people. You know, we talk a lot about fitness and weight and health and just addictions and therapy because honestly, I'll be helpful to the point that you let me help you.
Right.
And I'm going to do it with sense of humor and tough love because I don't sugarcoat nothing. I could give a fuck for these feelings.
Yeah.
You know, too bad.
Yeah.
But I like this podcast thing because the reason I even thought about getting into it was because I'm like, I want an hour a week where I don't have to play by press's rules.
Well,
like,
that's
you know how
it.
You have to do all that press.
And also, I mean, I'm going to have to do it this weekend and next weekend. And the other thing is that you don't have to be funny every 30 seconds and let it come out organically. Like I get that some comics want to have a podcast be an extension of their act and whatever, but like I'm interested in these real conversations with people that I think people should know about, whether they're names like yourself who they've heard and know, but now there's another dimension to you that they're going to learn and see, or people they don't know. I do think that we tend to sort of like stick with the things we like to know. So I think that's great. And you're going to be great at it because you're a natural conversationalist. So I think that's a big thing. And that comes through on a podcast.
Cool. Well, it did kind of spring out. We started doing a Q&A because one night I was really bored with the audience, not with them, but I was bored as a comic. I said, Frank, just come out. You're used to being on the radio, bring a mic and we're going to have you run around and get questions for the audience. Yeah. First of all, at the time he was fat, so it was hilarious watching him run. It was so funny. People are funny.
It was like a little waddle.
Smell of corduroy burning.
And then he rolls down. If he falls, he actually rolls.
So I was like, this is like how a podcast is where people tell you what their problems are and you fix them. And I remember, honestly, I really remember.
It went from questions about you to have this issue and.
Oh yeah.
Now, were you thin at the time?
And it was like 2 years ago.
And you were talking about this in your act, obviously.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, you can ask me any questions. Nothing's off limit. You know, the divorce, my dating problems, my celibacy, you know, the Trump stuff, you know, this and that. I said, and if you want some advice, I'm pretty fucking much better than you, so I could probably give you advice. I honestly had a girl break up with her meth head boyfriend, and she, the next time I went back to Vegas, she said, I broke up with him. I was like, because I gave her, I got tearful.
Yeah.
Because I said, you know, you hate yourself. I said, you need to work on you. Why are you bottom feeding? So it felt really good to talk to someone like that. Then another girl, I remember giving a full makeover. Let me tell you something, Paul. This bitch comes on stage looking like Old Navy. She left. She was so hot. She got raped in the parking lot because, you know, you only get raped if you're good looking.
Yeah, exactly.
As Mariska Hargitay will tell you on Law and Order.
I always never live to, I just rape them whether they're good looking or not.
Good for
old,
you,
young.
Damn it.
So when did you know that you needed to really start fixing this? Like, so you have an issue with relationships. You have this issue with food. You must have been sick and tired of
being the fat
being
chick.
Fat, feeling fat. There's sort of the, you're killing on stage and your career's going up, but you're not that happy. So was there a moment where something happened? You're like, I gotta change this now.
Yeah. I was on Celebrity Apprentice with Trump, and this wasn't the moment, but it was a very contributing. It all converged at that time. Now, at the time I was 248 pounds, a real battle axe. Mm. Wasn't the great beauty you see before you.
Yeah, exactly.
So Donald Trump.
By the
way,
I'm doing this entire interview with a hard on.
Oh, well, I am too. That's what's crazy. I strapped it on before I came
She
in.
Has one of the best penises in comedy.
Oh my God, it's huge. It's girthy. So Trump every day would go around and compliment the women on the panel, right, at The Apprentice. So I know he's not going to compliment
You mean like
me.
The way he complimented like the president of France's
not
wife?
As,
like
pretty closely.
Yeah. You look good today.
Yeah. Like. Oh my God, dude, that's so funny because he literally would say, Teresa, you look beautiful today. Aubrey, you look more attractive every week. Then one day, I'm not thinking he's going to say anything about me. I swear to God, he goes, Lisa. And I'm like, oh my God. And he goes, doesn't Teresa look beautiful today? I swear to God. And at that point, I go, I'm invisible.
Yeah.
And you know what? There's that point. Every woman hits 50 or hits a certain weight or a handicap and you're invisible. And I said, you know what? Not only am I invisible, that's okay, but I don't want to be invisible to me and hate myself. So I went to this weight loss surgeon, and me and Jimmy Big Balls, my husband at the time, the doctor looks at us, and honest to God, Paul, he goes, how many 70-year-olds do you know that are alive at your weight? And I remember thinking, okay, I'm 50, man, because now I'm 56. What the fuck? I want more than 20 years because I got a lot to do.
Yeah.
You know, I like my life now.
So why do you go to a surgeon? Why aren't you, like, turning to a weight loss plan, serious, hardcore?
Oh, because I tried every single weight loss thing from 18, literally a 500-calorie a day diet to when my hair fell out. I mean, to Weight Watchers.
So why didn't
Jenny
they work?
Craig.
It was because emotionally you needed that food. So if you didn't get that foundation fixed, you weren't going to, you were temporarily sort of, okay, I'm good. But then something would happen.
Eat out of pain or celebration or whatever makes me eat.
If you had a bad set or you were having a bad run in your career, you'd start chowing down.
Nail it at the diner.
And then you're on the road and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you go to Waffle House.
Oh, Waffle House. That's a good shit after a Waffle House. Shit is the best.
Talk about fucking things. I fuck waffles in that place.
Oh my God. Put them around your penis and have fun. But so then I decided before the surgery, though, I got to start going to the shrink and the emotional eating retreats and the therapies and all that.
So it's, you
so
had
that
a consciousness
I don't
that you
gain
had.
Gain it back.
You at
so
least
I say,
knew
cut
that.
Cut the stomach out. But guess what? 5 years after the surgery, I guarantee you work on it every day still. Every day I go, am I eating out of hunger or am I eating out of feelings? And unless you get the surgery with that in mind, you're going to gain it back.
Yeah,
there's
I got a friend. He actually, really good guy, sweet guy, GM of a comedy club. I don't want to miss his name. And he had the surgery and he can't eat big portions, but I don't know what it's.
Well, I'll tell you what they do. My doctor said, he goes, first of all, you have to work on yourself emotionally. Second, he goes, don't eat your slippery slope foods, meaning, you can shove a lot of ice cream down there. You can shove a lot of milkshakes down there. Like you find these foods that you can get away with. And if you don't, hey, I have to weigh myself once a week so I stay on point.
Oh.
And trust me, I hate it. I get scared shitless. I take a huge dump before every time I get on the scale. I don't care if I don't eat until noon. I am fucking making that happen. But it's weird. It's like, it has to be in my mind for the rest of my life or I'm like an alcoholic. I'm going to go back to it.
Is it exhausting?
Yes. Why do you get wrote a play about it? What the fuck? I got to get something out of this shit. And everybody knows you need to do theater for
I've
the
been
money.
Meditating. Alan Havey's like, you got to meditate.
He's
you got to meditate.
He's right.
Do you meditate?
No.
So I've meditated and then I And I've been doing it, and it's good. I think it's helping. I don't know. But my brain, once I get up in the morning, I start going, and then you start worrying, and then you start thinking about stuff you got to do.
Yep.
And you know, Leno said something to me once. He goes, you know, we don't get paid, you know, when you're making it really big, you don't get, at any level where you're like a pro, you don't get paid the money you get paid to do what you do on stage. Mm-hmm. You do that for free. It's to put up with a lot of the bullshit off stage, which is goes back to what you were saying, is sort of running into these walls. And if you don't have this incredible self-confidence, but you had the presence of mind to know you had to fix yourself emotionally while you were doing that.
Oh yeah.
And what did you find? How did you fix? What was the thing that needed to be fixed the most for you emotionally? And how did you fix it? Because it sounds like you came from a very supportive family and all of that. So maybe not those issues, but was there other stuff?
What was wild about my parents, this is what I found so sad. They did not ever praise us too much or too little. They were those parents you really like, which are the ones who are like, you're great, you're fine, you're not the best. Like, they weren't helicopter parents, they were just normal parents. So I go, why do I have these issues if I had these normal parents? Guess what I realized last year, which makes me so sad? They role modeled self-hate. They didn't like themselves. So my mother would eat out of feeling less than. My father would put up with crap at work, feeling less than. They were brought up by parents, possibly, I don't know intimate details, who didn't instill that they were great people. So they role modeled, and I observed my mother's eating out of sadness.
And then also that manifested itself by them sort of not giving you that sort of, you're the best, you're the best.
No, no, but I don't think parents should say you're the best. It should be, you're great.
You think that part of it was fine?
I think that's what I said. I said to a shrink, I was crying, and I said, my parents never shit on us, because you hear everybody in the group therapy, my parents said you're bad, you're fat. My parents were always like, you're fine. What's wrong with you? You're fine. So I go, what is wrong with me? Did I make this up? And it was like, no, because I got a sense that they didn't like themselves. So it's role modeled opposed to done to you.
Yeah, you know,
being, and I thought that was sad because they're good people.
I mean, I think one of the things you learn as a comic is people are very intuitively smart. Mm-hmm. I always say audiences may not be IQ smart, but they fucking know in a heartbeat if you're a bullshit artist, if they can sniff bullshit a mile away. And I think every human being can do that. And I guess sounds like intuitively you were picking up something from your parents and the way they felt about themselves. And then that sort of was instilled
in you.
It
stuck with me. And I'm like, but isn't it funny how it took me, you know, 55 years old to realize it was nothing they did to me?
See,
it was how I saw.
But I'm trying to figure out the chicken or the egg here. Was it the food that made you self-hate, or was the self-hate the thing that caused the food?
Oh, here's what it is. I go away to college, so I start. I'm totally lonely and alone and in housing with seniors as a freshman, so I'm lonely. I have no friends. Well, my mother had comforted us with food and used food in a happy way every Sunday or whatever. Go to food. Not moving, then eating and not moving. So then you gain the weight, endless spiral of horrible diets.
Harder to want to diet.
18 to 50. And that's when I said, enough, I want to live longer. And I was like, okay, it's the emotional work I got to do. So I think what really started clicking was, I'm going to go through every avenue, whether it's meditation or yoga or, you know, spiritual retreats or mindful eating, and figure out why the F I eat. And guess what, Paul? Guess what? You never figure out exactly why, but you go, oh, at least I know when it's not hunger.
Yeah. And what part of, which of those avenues that you chose, was it straight up one-on-one therapy that really got you the most in terms of understanding all this? Or was it some combination?
I think it's a combination of that. And I took a class at Kripalu. It's this meditation retreat place up in the Berkshires called Hunger, Hope, and Healing. And it's about, you know, not going to food out of anything but physical hunger, and about using yoga and things like that. Now, I don't do no yoga. I think yoga was something invented by some fag so he could suck his own cock for himself, which I don't blame them. I would too. But
it actually was called Cocksucking 101, and they changed it because it wasn't marketing well.
Now, I would have gone to Cocksucking 101 because I'm terrible at it. But yeah,
I can't believe that. Oh, well, no, I can't, because your mouth never
horrible.
Stops moving.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not like Jim Norton says, it's the wood chipper, you know? But yeah, I think it's a combination of, you try everything till you see the thing that clicks.
Yeah, some things like,
a sentence.
Group therapy might work for you, but it doesn't work for me. So in Stuffed, you have it's not a one-person play. Oh, no. Obviously, you have an ensemble, and I was reading their bios. You got some serious actors in that
shit.
I couldn't
believe it.
And you wrote it, and you wrote it from this place where you needed to write it for yourself, and now it sounds like for others. So how much of this play are you talking about the, you know, this struggle with yourself emotionally and all of that and the therapy and all of that, and how much is this is focused on the food and sort of where does that all play out?
Yeah, there's a lot threaded throughout about the emotional pull of food and why we go to it and stuff, but it's mostly done. I would say the play is 60% funny and then emotional moments throughout.
Like each your act, girl okay.
Has, yeah. Thanks for giving me that higher percentage. I appreciate it. And each of the girls has a moment where they hit bottom and they figure out what they have to do to work on themselves. So a lot of the therapeutic stuff's in there. But I had to write three different characters.
Yeah, explain to people. It's really interesting because you created and wrote characters that sort of represent the major aspects of this eating issue that people have.
Yeah, so there's an anorexic. Which I was never lucky enough to be an anorexic. That would have been great. There's a skinny girl who can't gain weight, which most people don't think is a problem, but it's once you see the play, you go, oh, that sucks for her. And there's the one thing I could never be that I wish I could have been is the big girl who has confidence and true confidence.
But
not
wait, isn't there a bulimic
shit.
Too or no?
Well, anorexic and bulimic. And they
same.
Kind of,
okay. You kind of,
at times
same.
She waffles back and forth.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But the fat girl, that she's played by Nikki Blonsky from Hairspray.
Yeah.
She fucking likes herself. If I had been able to accept myself, this is what kills me, Paul. My sister's been overweight since birth. She has never had a day where I see her feeling less than.
How do they do that?
I think because she was so used to it that she survived high school, grammar school, and it was
but how
just
do you,
stayed
but I do,
standing.
How do they have the strength to go? And maybe it's because I'm a comic and this is why I do this.
I don't
If my
know.
Mother hugged me two more times, I wouldn't be doing this. But like, how do you have the strength inherently to go,
I'm fine.
I know I've got 80% of the world looking at me like I'm a fat fuck and a loser, but I don't give a shit. How do they have the strength to not care about what people think and say?
I have a feeling that she powered through the most difficult years and then it became easy. So basically, once you get to college, you're big girl. I mean, she wasn't obese, but she was big girl. She was like, yeah, I'm cool. She was president of her class. She was a really high achiever. She had a great husband, two kids. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure days go by where she makes fun of herself and stuff. She always laughs about herself. But there's not that kernel of self-hate I see in so many of these women that I had that was like, oh, my God, I'm
okay,
less
but she,
than.
But see, this is what I don't understand either because I have siblings and we all have our issues. She's brought up, your sister's brought up in the same household. Yeah. I don't know, is there a big age difference?
Nope.
There you
years.
Go. Okay, perfect. So sample it, right? It's just like a scientific experiment.
Yeah.
Two people, same wholesale, same age, same seeing your parents self-hate.
Yeah.
You suck it all in like a sponge and it bounces off her like Teflon.
Right.
Why?
Maybe because you said, remember you said I was super intuitive and felt it? Maybe she's fucking stupid. No, maybe she just didn't take it in. She was the oldest. Also, the birth order counts. Oldest, she was probably busy doing something else. Maybe her issue was feeling less than after I was born.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got a little brother who's never had a food issue. So you go, Jesus Christ, we're all fucked in the head.
Sounds like you took it in for all three
I
of you.
I really did get fucked. maybe I was cornholed, but have repressed the
memory. You took it
in
the mouth and the ass.
Yeah, and cunt. Mouth, ass, and cunt. But isn't it interesting?
But of the characters that I read that you created for this play, that overweight, confident one was the most fascinating to me.
Oh, wait till
you
see. Yeah.
Because I really am. Yeah. And you see it more. You know, Melissa McCarthy and big stars really carry it well and don't give a shit or at least appear not to.
Right.
And I can imagine how hard it is to sort of be sort of on the fringe, you know, in terms of weight.
I hated it.
And that you were able to sort of pull it together. So how did the play change from last year when you sort of ran it and then I was reading that you said you went back and you rewrote and you learned a lot. What did you learn?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when you have a budget now, because before we even closed before the run ended at the WP, we already had financing. So
did you? You had investors come in.
Yeah.
So you financed that yourself and then you had.
No. WP is a nonprofit theater.
Right.
And you always sort of try to do a show at a nonprofit first because you're accepted. So it like gives you credibility.
Oh, okay.
So I had this investor come in and he just like was like, I've had these issues. Oh my God, my whole family has this issue, and wrote the check. So you go, I'm so fortunate to meet this guy.
How
so
did
this,
you even find your investors? Just
I went to the Friars Club and I said to them, do you have any people I want to do a showcase? Do you have like 10 people who can like maybe want to invest in theater? Because the Friars loves being involved with entertainment. And they go, we know this one guy who we know lost a lot of weight. Maybe just have dinner with him and see what he said. Before we even get the appetizers, he's like, oh, fuck, I'm investing in this show. That's Came great. To see it and he wrote the check.
That's great.
So I got very blessed with that. Then the general manager of Hamilton came to see it and was like, I'm in. Then the director.
As an investor.
No. They general managed the whole show, no, but they don't have to do anything but Hamilton, but he loved the, yeah. This resonated.
Yeah.
I said, okay, this is good. So the team's coming together. I'm like, oh, this is supposed to be meant to be. So now that you have money, you could spend money on, you know, these high-end actors. You could spend money on real costumes, real sets. I mean, beautiful, like a real show. Mm. And I, other than changing in those ways, it also changed in the fact that I made it more of a fantasy, meaning it's not four girls sitting around chatting. Unfortunately, with the budget we had last time, it was kind of more like, how do these girls even know each other? The New York Times liked it, but they were like, how do these women even get in the same room together? So I made it more of a fantasy of four women who sort of come together. And, you know, when you see the play, you see how.
Mm.
So I took some good advice from some good critics and was like, oh, they're right. Like, this is me. Well, I'm fucking new at this. Mm. You're going to have some critics from tell me what needs to change and I'm not going to take the advice. Yeah. Am I retarded?
Good for you.
Because I think it's so stupid to not take advice. Yeah, I will never take advice as a comic because I think I'm better than Richard Pryor. I'm so delusional. But as a playwright, I who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
I'm no Beethoven, even though he's not a playwright. I'm no Mozart. You know,
so, I'm no Moses. No, yeah, it's Mozart,
yeah,
idiot.
Yeah, right? So yeah. I take advice. And I'm so proud of it. Like, I can't even believe.
That's great.
I did it.
It's so great. Did you feel, you say, you know, you wouldn't take advice from comics. It triggered something.
Yeah.
And we all get judged by other comics. Mm. I think everybody judges everybody in their respective professions, accountants, sure. Lawyers. Did you ever get a vibe or get from people like, oh, she does insults?
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's it. And how did you, you know, because comics aren't the most supportive group generally.
Oh, they're horrible. Except how did
you? How did you deal? Yeah, how did you deal with that? Like, how did you? Did you confront them? Did you just let it roll off your back?
For the time I was in New York doing The Cellar and this and that, I was miserable. I hated everybody.
Because you felt like they were
super mean.
They were looking down their nose.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
I always thought your act was great, and I always loved watching you.
But you know what's funny? I took it like when Patrice would be mean or Geraldo or this one. I always joke in my act. I go, there's three comics who gave me shit in my life. Greg Geraldo, Joan Rivers, and Patrice O'Neill. What do they have in common? And they're like, they're dead. And I'm like, yeah, you're next, Louis C.K. Actually, he never fucked with me. It's just funny to say. But I always felt sad about it.
They would pick. They would give you shit about the fact you're doing insult jokes and all.
Oh, and everything, make fun of me and just be mean. And I was like, oh my God, they're so mean. And I'm soft. I'm a pussycat on the inside. Like,
did you think about changing your act because you weren't being accepted?
No.
Your act wasn't being accepted by these cool guys.
Nope. Because I saw Steve Byrne one night, and I love him so much. Mm. And he was jumping around and doing crazy voices. And I thought he was at his best when he did that. And I remember they all gave him so much shit, he stopped doing that. And I didn't like his act anymore. And he wasn't Steve anymore. He was like doing monology shit.
Mm.
And I'm just like, dude, you fucking suck now. And I told him, I said, I'm sorry, but I like the Steve Byrne. I like the real guy. So I guess I think it's
what
my
age.
What
did he say? He just never went back to that, though.
I don't remember.
I don't think he does. Yeah, he's
which
he's
is too bad because I just loved how funny.
And they were like, they were basically either saying like, or implying
hack,
they're hacky.
Hack. Yeah. And I'd always go, well, if I'm a fucking hack, I'm making a shitload more money than you are anyway. But that's the wrong thing to default to also. It's a defense. So I know that what I did was funny in my heart, but it would hurt my feelings, but not enough to change it. Because in my gut, I go, I'm on to something.
See, but here's the thing that's not connecting for me. You have this self-hate that you it manifested itself through food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put ourselves out on stage and expose yourself emotionally naked. You're doing an act. Your peers, some of them, are busting your balls about it, saying it's hacky, it's blah, 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 it's this and that. And that doesn't force you to go eat food. You're able
because
to
again,
be strong
remember,
with that.
Remember the confidence I really had this fake that I felt was real confidence. So I felt like I was so terrific.
No, I understand that. I'm not asking the question well.
But as a human, as a when you come to food and eating, I always felt less than as a human, as a woman.
Right, but I don't know how that. It's great. I'm happy for you. You were able to separate the two out. It's almost like there are two people in you.
Confidence in some areas. And then, well, we all do. Like, you could be have no confidence in yourself as a husband, but know you're a great comic.
Yeah.
You could have, you know. Yeah. So right now, like, I always say.
So that never affected you as a comic. It made you feel bad, but you're never like, okay, maybe I should change my act so the cool guys like me.
Oh, fuck no. Well, because also, somebody in the business, this was so funny. Maybe this was an intervention at the right time.
Right.
I was in LA for 2 years. This comic on the street said, I said, fuck these comics. I go, they ain't paying me. And he goes, yeah, he goes, I always heard you need to worry about two groups of people, industry and audience. Fuck other comics. They ain't paying you. And I go, oh my God, he's so right.
Yeah.
So I think I always knew it would be nice to be accepted. But then I'd get the occasional peer who was so nice that I go, oh, if Mark Maron likes me, then fuck these guys.
Yeah.
Like, so you'd get this like weird kind of go, oh, so that's a good guy.
Yeah.
He's not jealous or he's not threatened that I'm killing on
stage.
And
I think it was that jealousy. And
I think so too. And I would never accept that because you go to self-hate.
Yeah.
So thank God a Maron or somebody would come in and go, oh, okay, I'm okay, I'm okay.
You mean if you accept a person's jealousy or envy toward you, you're giving in and saying, yeah, they're right, and then you're self-hating.
Oh, no,
and then
no,
you're
I
changing.
Mean, if I accepted, oh, they're threatened by me, that would mean I would think I'm a big shot.
Yeah.
You know what
I
mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But now that I could sit back, I said, it was probably a combination of their own self-hate, because why judge other people if you like yourself?
Yeah.
Like right now, you can ask me about any comic on the planet, and I don't have a bad word to say about them as a comic, because it's none of my business.
Yeah.
Like you could say, oh, aren't you mad about this one's act or that one's act? And you go, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because who am I? They have an audience.
Yeah.
I can't judge that.
Yeah.
Yes, I can say, I don't get it.
Mm.
That's the most I'll ever say about a comic.
Mm.
Look, I don't get some of these younger comics with the long stories and the this, the that. I don't get it. Have a punchline. But it's not me saying they're bad.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just not supposed to get it.
Yeah.
So it's not, weird. Yeah. It's an evolution how we have to make.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, I could talk to you forever. You're going to come
God,
on again.
So much
once
fun.
Once the play's up and running and you're kind of in a rhythm, let's just do another and just hang out.
Yeah.
And so the play, October 5th, is in previews. October 19th, West Side Theater. Tickets are on sale.
Yes.
And you're off the road for a while.
Yes. For tickets, just real quick, stuffedplay.com or telecharge. I always wanted to say telecharge because that's like Hamilton. Isn't that cute?
It's like you made it big time when you can say telecharge.
I know.
It's not Carnegie Hall. I said telecharge for my play.
Ticketmaster.
It's so awesome,
telecharge.
Man. And I... And also your podcast.
Yes, Get Stuffed with Lisa Lampanelli on iTunes.
Once a week it posts?
Yeah, every Wednesday.
Okay.
And honestly, I'll help you, but I'm going to be mean.
But she means mean in a
loving way.
I'm so happy for you. I always thought you were great. I always think you're great. And this is so great to see an artist evolve into something else.
Thank you.
And you took something that was not great and made it something great. And you're helping other people.
Yeah, thank you.
And you're a bony ass, skinny twat now that I wouldn't want to bang you for $1,000. I liked your fat rolls.
Oh, man, they all did.
No, you skinny bitch. Love you.
No, thank you, Paul, sincerely
for
having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to hang out and go see the play. And if you haven't seen her comedy, you're out of your mind. There's specials out there. There's CDs out there. And she's working Washington Square Park Tuesday night for
every
$6.
Every Tuesday night.
All right.
Yep.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks.
All right, that was Lisa Lampanelli. I really enjoyed having her on. She's really made a, you know, sort of a really cool arc with her career, and this play is really cool, and she looks great, and she looks like a gay poodle with the hair purple, but other than that, I guess gay poodle's redundant. But anyway, it's great to have her on, and thanks for checking out the podcast. Please go to iTunes, leave some comments. Always great to hear what you guys think of the show. And please send the links around and keep an eye on me on Facebook and Twitter. I got all my stuff going on there. So, and we'll catch you guys next week. Appreciate you checking out the podcast.